1796. January, February, March. 3 months in which the British take Ceylon thanks to some daring, or perhaps that should be dairying, exploits.
He sends a message to De Meuron Jr. hidden inside a cheese. He peels away a bit, takes a bit of the rind off, sticks this letter in and seals it back on, and sends it over by a messenger.
Napoleon Bonaparte takes command of the Army of Italy.
I would argue that the army Napoleon takes to Italy is the best army that France ever has.
And the new French government, the Directory, struggles to find its way.
You ask who's running France. That's not very clear because you have five men of different political orientation. That's why they've been picked. And nothing to keep them together, really.
I'm Alexander Stevenson, and this is episode 17 of the Napoleonic Quarterly, covering 3 months in which it feels like the Edam is about to break over this conflict. The Napoleonic Quarterly takes the epic conflicts of the 1792 to 1815 period 3 months at a time. And for the 3 months covered by this episode, you'll hear from Philip Ball, Bianca Maria Fontana, and Rafe Blaufarb. But for this episode, and indeed, it rather looks like for all the episodes in season three, I am once again delighted to confirm that this podcast is blessed with the presence of two of the most distinguished professorial brains examining this period, namely Professor Emeritus Charles Esdale of the University of Liverpool and Professor Alexander Mikaburidze of Louisiana State University, Shreveport. Charles, that was the viewers can't see all your excellent royal wave, but it's very good. Charles, welcome back. It's been a few months. What have you been up to?
What have I been up to? I've been finishing my book on English Civil War ghosts, which is now packed off to the publisher in the United States.
Excellent.
And I have had an article published in the Journal of Advanced Military Studies in the United States on wargaming Waterloo.
Yes, and that is almost a separate podcast in itself, I think, wargaming Waterloo, that's for sure. And Alex, what's been keeping you busy?
Well, like Charles, I've been writing, finished my book on Field Marshal Kutuzov. It's off my hands now. And at long last, I think we brought to conclusion the big Cambridge History of Napoleonic Wars, of which I'm one of the editors, and Charles is one of the contributors.
Oh, wow. That sounds brilliant. Oh, I look forward to that. Well, it's excellent to have you both here for season three. And we've made it between us so far through the peak revolutionary period of 92 and 93, 94, 95. Well, now we have 2 years to chew over in which things do change rather a bit. And it's certainly, I must say, having done the interviews for this season, there is a change of pace, let's say, certainly a whirlwind to come. So let's kick off season three. We're going to be looking at 1796 and 97 in the forthcoming episodes. But this episode is looking at these opening 3 months of that period. Here's some headline developments. And in mid-February, British forces take Colombo, the capital of modern-day Sri Lanka, confirming overall British control of Ceylon, and in particular its very valuable port of Trincomalee. On Saint-Domingue, Toussaint Louverture comes to the aid of Governor Laveau in Cap, where the people of colour are rising up against the Frenchman, but thankfully for him, Toussaint's able to calm things down. Meanwhile, though, you've got a British fleet sailing across the Atlantic during this 3 months with other French colonies in the Caribbean in its sights. On the European mainland, on the Rhine, there's an Austro-French armistice underway on New Year's Day, but the French are beginning to build up their forces along the Rhine with a view to a two-pronged offensive into Germany once the weather improves. And if the armies of Moreau and Jourdan do go as planned, then War Minister Lazare Carnot's big idea is that they'll eventually link up with the Army of Italy, which from March, or the end of March, is commanded by Napoleon Bonaparte. This is a big month for this young French general who we're hearing a little bit about, who's got married to someone called Josephine before heading off to inspect his 60,000-odd men. So more on that later on. But Charles and Alex, here we go again. And just to go back to basics, really, as we're at the start of another series, I wondered, Alex, could you talk through, of the major powers at this stage, who's at war with who in Europe? And what does that mean for the rest of the world?
Let me outline quickly. So in Europe, we see what's happening within the context of the War of the First Coalition. We see the France arrayed against a number of European powers united in this First Coalition, of whom the most important, of course, are the Austrians and the British, since this Spain, as we already discussed in previous episodes, has already negotiated a separate treaty with France and left the coalition, just as Prussians did the same year. When we look how, and of course, when we look on the at the European powers, the one big power, I mean, one of the superpowers really missing is Russia. Russia is not involved in the War of the First Coalition for a number of reasons. We've discussed that Russians were more keen on taking advantage of international situation to aggrandize themselves in places like Poland, in places like Caucasus. In fact, when we discuss these events of the first 3 months of 1796, you know, Russian attention is less fixed on events in Western Europe and more, for example, in places like Northern Caucasus, where in April of 1796, a major campaign is launched by the Empress Catherine against Iran in response to the Iranian invasion of Georgia, which was a Russian ally. Of course, across the Atlantic, we see in February of 1796, finally the Jay Treaty, right, the treaty that the United States, the fledgling American Republic, and Britain negotiated in the wake of American Revolutionary War, was initially signed in 94. In February of 96, that treaty actually enters into force. I think, broadly speaking, we see the attention of European powers focused not necessarily on France. For British or the Russians, attention is somewhere else. And that's a very important thing to consider when we talk about their policies and strategies.
Well, thanks, Alex. Yes, that was an excellent whistle stop. I was putting you on the spot there. And in terms of wondering who exactly is at war with everyone else. But that's the sort of big picture that we're looking for, the overall situation. And Charles, I might ask you something similar, but maybe ask you about the question marks. You know, what are the big question marks hanging over Europe at the start of 1796? The big question marks here.
Well, I could be quite arch and say that, you know, perhaps what becomes the biggest question is Josephine de Beauharnais fertile? And of course, that question increasingly hangs in the air, and we will return to it. Of course, initially, the state of European gynecology being what it was, who knew? And Napoleon, shall we say, was busying himself trying to find out. But we won't say too much about that.
Well, you've certainly planted a seed that's going to continue here, Charles, a plot line that will keep following.
Use the phrase planted a seed.
Maybe not. Oh dear. Well, okay, look, yes, I'm not quite sure that Josephine was the mind you, Josephine did have a bit of reputation even at this stage, didn't she?
She had a very considerable reputation. She was what I believe was referred to in the days of my youth as a goer.
Oh, crikey. Well, I didn't expect the Napoleonic Quarterly to descend to such depths so quickly, but here we are. And of course, the reason we're talking about Josephine is because she's hooked up with Bonaparte, who, if we're being very strict, he's achieved one or two things by now. He was certainly helpful. But is it not the case that he's basically in charge of the Army of Italy because he's mates with Barra.
Well, of course, at this point, he is not in... I mean, if you're talking about the beginning of 1796, he is not in charge of the Army of Italy.
Ah, so this is the 3 months when he's doing the networking to get the job.
Well, and the previous 3 months, because, of course, he'd been in Paris since the autumn of 1795. I mean, he was certainly there, of course, in the Whiff of Grapeshot episode and so forth. So, yes, I mean, Napoleon at this point is not quite so obscure as he was, staff officer, who has been interesting himself greatly in the possibilities of a campaign in Italy. It was, you know, he actually developed quite a few plans. It was something he showed a real interest in. And Barra sits up, Barra, who is one of the directors, sits up and takes notes and sees Napoleon, or Bonaparte, as we should really call him at this point, sees him as very much his man. Another question that's hanging over us, of course, is the extent to which Bonaparte was anybody's man other than himself. However, so the whole question of Bonaparte is, if you like, Bonaparte hasn't emerged onto the stage big time yet, but he is about to.
I do want to point out one thing, Alex, that Barra historically has been kind of credited with appointing Napoleon to lead the Army of Italy. But we oftentimes forget that he's not necessarily the man who made that decision. He would have been one of the men. But another, I think, in many respects, more crucial voice was Lazare Carnot, who in November of 1795 becomes the member of Directory, and who was, as we all know, very keenly involved in military affairs of France during the Revolution. And Bonaparte, while he was working at the Bureau Topographique in Paris, was very closely working with Lazare Carnot, who got to know him well, so that it is, in many respects, Carnot who makes that decision to send him to Italy, since he got to know this young man. And they have clearly an alignment of minds on what needs to be done in Italy. So as important as Barra is at Directory, I personally think it's Carnot who picks Napoleon, and Barra then kind of approves him.
Well, Carnot is certainly a fascinating figure who's trying to see the bigger picture for the first time, you know, looking at the operations of not just one army, but many armies all the way from the centre in Paris. But let's try, Charles, and take the picture to an even bigger scale. If you sort of step away from Josephine, as it were, and think about the very broad situation.
There is a question beyond Europe that we should think about, really. Increasingly, we're seeing a period in which European powers are going to be coming into contact with Asian states. If those states are going to survive, going to thrive, going to be able to face up to Western pressure, they're going to have to modernize. They've got very traditional, old-style, if you want, feudal armies. And all the way from India through Persia to the Ottoman Empire, we see native rulers trying to build up European-style armies. So you see the Indian states doing it. You see the Persian Empire doing it. And ultimately, you see the Ottoman Empire doing it under Sultan Selim III, who very conveniently actually comes to power in 1789. It's a nice coincidence. And progress is at its greatest in India. The point is this: the extent of this process of modernization is obviously going to be an important factor in the wars with the European powers. The extent to which it impacts upon those wars is in turn going to have a corresponding effect, if you like, on the ability of those powers to wage war in Europe. I might point out, incidentally, that you actually see the same sort of thing happening in the Western Hemisphere in Haiti. What Toussaint Louverture and his chaps have got to do, ultimately, is build a Western-style army.
And That's a very useful intro, Charles, to our first segment, which is very much in that frame of reference. Arguably, the biggest development in military and strategic terms in this 3 months is the fall of Ceylon. There you've got an example of a British amphibious effort so beloved of Philip Ball, the historian and author, and regular listeners will have heard him talking us through events in the Low Countries in seasons 1 and 2. And in fact, the final defeat of the Dutch and their allies at the beginning of 1795 is the starting point for his next contribution, which is heading well beyond Europe's shores.
The British retreat from Holland, get back on their boats in Bremen, and come back home. Holland is taken over by the French. The Prince of Orange got on a boat and came to London. In the meantime, the French, as you may recall, captured the Dutch fleet and frozen the Texel, and they march into Amsterdam, and that what was the United Provinces of the Netherlands becomes the Batavian Republic, which is a satellite of the French Republic, basically. Now, from a British perspective, that's a bit of a bong. That's a, oh dear. Because, first of all, from the beginning of the war, British strategy was all about defending the Netherlands. Well, obviously, yeah. We failed there. That's scrapped. Not only have we failed in that, but we've now got a major maritime power on the opposite side, and all their colonies are in rather important strategic places. They're not too concerned that the Dutch are going to be a problem, but they think that the French might take the weakly held Dutch colonies and use them as bases to attack our trade and maritime power.
So which of these colonies were top of the list?
Top of the list. Well, they've got a few in the West Indies, which we're always interested in, but Ceylon is the biggest one. Ceylon is the one that ticks all the boxes. Very close to India, immensely important. Trincomalee in the sort of to the northwest of Ceylon, one of the biggest, safest harbours in India at the in the whole of that sort of region at the time. And according to various contemporary reports, Britain didn't have a decent port. So we've got Madras and we've got Bombay and we've got Calcutta. But apparently, when the weather was really bad, the shipping wasn't safe there. So Trincomalee is top of the British shopping list for Asia, certainly.
And what was the timings for this? This was being thought through in 1795 and then initiated, I suppose. And
it's so pretty much day one. They're very very reactive, the British government. I mean, there's only three of them running the thing. So the whole of British foreign policy is run by Pitt, Dundas and Grenville. And so the Prince of Orange turns up in London and they sit him down and they say, "It'd be awfully nice of you, you know, as we're looking after you, if you were to write to the governors of all your colonies and get them to surrender to us."
Did it work?
Not really, because the Prince of Orange isn't as daft as he looks.
Right.
And so he writes these letters, sure enough, but in no way do they say you're to surrender the colony to the British. He says you are to admit them as friends and allies, which, well, right. When they turn up in, this letter or a copy of this letter goes to the Honourable East India Company at Madras, and they say, "Well, that's it, splendid, right, we'll get some lads together, a few ships, we'll send them out with this letter, and here's my instructions to," the governor was a chap called Anglebeek. So we're going to write to Van Anglebeek and tell him, "It's all right, mate. You're relieved. We're taking over."
And so they knew exactly what they were doing. It was a case of, yeah, we're very much friends and allies. And that friendship is going to be enforced with these guns and ships.
Exactly. Yes. So they take what the Prince of Orange said and they move it up a notch and say, right, well, yeah, he hasn't said what we want him to say, but we'll say he did.
Right. It's lost in translation.
That's kind of how it worked, though, certainly in India. Sure enough, they get their guys on the ships, and they go over to Trincomalee, and they present Van Anglebreek with the letter from the Prince of Orange and the letter from the Governor of Madras saying, hand it over, mate. And he reads the letter from the Prince of Orange and says, that's not what he says.
So this ultimatum taking place in late 1795, but by the start of the 3 months recovering in this episode, New Year 1796, yep, Things are moving on a bit.
Absolutely. Well, having been rebuffed, the governor at Madras basically sends his lads in. They land at Trincomalee and a formal siege. You know, they dig saps and blow stuff up. I mean,
well, how we've said it's fairly straightforward, just rock up with men in boats. But how complicated was this? It sounds like it wasn't a pushover.
It wasn't quite as straightforward as the British hope, because they actually lose a ship on the way in, gets stuck on the rocks, and they have to land elsewhere further along. But there's not much actual fighting. We shell them a bit, they shell us a bit. There was a sort of sally by some native troops that the Dutch had attacked one of our artillery positions one night, but that was basically it. And after a short siege, I think it's 3 weeks, if I remember, they surrender. And that's Trincomalee gone. So that's a big tick on the British wants list. But they want to have the whole island now. So they go off to Colombo, which is the capital then and now. They land further around the coast near Colombo, and they march basically through the jungles and passes, and nobody stops them. And even the British troops involved, it's like, well, this is pretty good ambush country. Why is nobody ambushing us?
Yes.
And so they...
So it sounds like a relief for the British that what could have been quite challenging was turning into something fairly straightforward, and they've got a really big prize.
Not quite a walk in the park, but certainly not what you'd expect for as you say, quite a big prize.
Okay, so then it comes down to Colombo then, and this final struggle for the prize of Sri Lanka and Ceylon as it was. So how did things finally, pan out in the end?
The largest contingent of the Colombo garrison were a regiment called Demurons Swiss Regiment. Bizarrely, and this has already been fairly weird, but it gets more bizarre, a Scottish academic, a chap called Cleghorn, who was a professor at, I think, St. Andrews University in Scotland, he was mates with Charles de Muron, who was the colonel proprietor of this regiment. Cleghorn has the amazing idea that he can get de Muron to transfer his regiment to British service. Now, this is before they've even thought about going to Ceylon. He just thinks they'd be much better off with the British. And de Muron's been moaning. Basically, he's not been paid by the Dutch. His contract is nearly up. And he's looking for a new outlet for his troops. And the amazing coincidence that they happen to be the major part of the Ceylon garrison, it sort of goes together quite nicely. So when Cleghorn mentions this to the government, that he thinks he can turn this guy, they're like, yeah, get yourself off to Switzerland. Yeah, see if you can get this guy on board. Offer him some money. Offer him whatever he wants, basically.
Wow.
And what he wants is to be a general in the British Army. And they're like, okay, fair enough. Yeah. And you can have I think they give him £5,000 as well.
Not bad.
Not bad. But he has to go with him. So Cleghorn and de Muron get on a ship. They sail all the way to India. And they rock up at Madras, where de Muron wants to go out in his general's uniform. It's like, no, this is supposed to be a secret mission. You can't go saluting the troops in Madras in your jet. The gig will be up. But I think he does it anyway. But so he's the colonel proprietor. The colonel on the ground is his brother. Also a Colonel de Muron, so it's a bit complicated. So Cleghorn, he seems to be a bit of an Ian Fleming type of character. He's very into the subterfuge, and it's his idea. And he sends a message to de Muron Jr. hidden inside a cheese. So So you imagine an Edam cheese. He peels away a bit, takes a bit of the rind off, sticks this letter in and seals it back on and sends it over by a messenger.
Well, that is completely superb. I think that's what this podcast was missing. We just hadn't had any secret messages and smuggled in Edam cheeses. So that's absolutely tremendous. But does it make the decisive difference here, or are there any holes? Or are there any holes in this cheese, or any holes in this plan?
Well, the cheese is very well received, as is its contents. And De Meuron, I get the impression, wasn't massively happy on Ceylon, and basically marches up to Van Anglebeek and says, "Right, I've got new marching orders. I'm off. The British are sending a ship for my troops." And Van Anglebeek is absolutely furious. "What do you mean? How dare you? No, you're not going anywhere." He's like, "Well, put it like this. I've got 500 armed men. How are you going to stop me?" So, yeah, the only concession there is that they have to leave their battalion guns behind. But the De Meuron regiment get on ships and they sail off to India and they serve in the British Army for the rest of the Napoleonic Wars.
Wow, this is not what I expected to be talking about, but it's quite. But you know, this is what's decisive, isn't it? You know,
this is what history is all about for me. Is these stories, you know, digging under the rind, as it were, and finding the, you know. Well, I read this thing. I thought, well, that's ridiculous. That's nonsense. I couldn't find anything to back it up at all. And then I found Cleghorn. There's a book on Cleghorn and his letters and whatnot in private hands, and he details this cheese thing entirely. So yeah, Van Anglebeek is now in a bit of a sticky situation.
Presumably it's game over for Van Anglebeek now.
He still doesn't think so. He's like, "Well, yeah, I've lost these 500 or whatever. I've still got troops. He writes to the British and say, "You might think this is it, but I'm not without means. I can still fight you, and I'm going to." The British duly turn up and move their way through the jungle until they get to this river. So there's a river in the jungle. Van Anglebeek's troops have constructed a redoubt with guns commanding the crossing places on this river. Now, to me, this is the weirdest thing that makes very little sense. The guns fire, depends which account you read, once or twice or all through the first day, depending who you believe in. And then the gunners throw the guns into the river and leg it into the jungle.
Oh.
Yeah.
Some more odd goings on here.
Odd goings on. Now, there are various suggestions as to why this might have happened. And it's largely due to them feeling, again, exposed. As with all amphibious operations, there's close support from the Navy going on. And they're worried that they're going to drop troops behind this position and outflank it, so they say. And the British are like, "Whoa, they've gone. Well, that was easy. Right, everyone across the river. Whee-hee!" They get across the river, and I can't remember if it was that night or the night after, but as they proceed, they are attacked. There is a general attempt to slow the British advance, but it's pretty ineffectual. Again, it depends whose account you read, because the Dutch and the French and the British all have very different views of what happens in these things. But basically, it's not very effective, and it's driven off very easily. And the British turn up outside Colombo. They're here. they start digging in their guns and unloading their supplies from down this river. And Van Anglebeek realizes that the gig's up now. This is it. He's like, "Well, I could carry on fighting, but we're all just going to die, aren't we? Or it's not going to go well." You know, his troops are a bit. He says he doesn't trust his troops. You know, there's a certain element of some of the native troops are starting to disappear into the jungle. That kind of thing is going on. So he surrenders, and that's it. The Ceylon becomes British.
That's Philip Ball telling us another quite astonishing story in his inimitable style. So, Alex, let's ask the question of how important Ceylon was then for the British. Why did Ceylon matter so much?
Ceylon, of course, is a strategically located island, especially for any power keenly interested in conducting trade in Asia. This is a waypoint that is crucial to control, which is why Portuguese and the Dutch and now the British were so keen on consolidating positions there. What I want to, however, note that 1796 is only the beginning of this process, right? In hindsight, we have the now the benefit of knowing that for the British, this is a long and uphill struggle, a struggle that will not be actually completed until after Napoleonic Wars. So 1796 and the entry of the British into Ceylonian politics is clearly guided by economic considerations, since it's the British East India Company that first acquires presence there. And as Charles was pointing out, this is, again, yet another area where the British have to pay attention to what's happening, have commitment of troops. I think at the height of it, the British garrison there was about 6,000 men. So it's a significant commitment on top of other imperial commitment that Britain has in Asia.
Well, thanks for that, Alex. And Charles, I suppose the question is why Britain was so committed to Ceylon. But more broadly, we haven't really talked too much about the subcontinent on this podcast just yet. So maybe we ought to have a little really quick intro to why the subcontinent mattered to the British in the late 1790s.
Well, quite simply, already India is the jewel in the crown. Of course, the British don't control India yet. And I was going to make the same point about Ceylon. Actually, it's wrong to talk about the conquest of Ceylon. What happens is rather that the British simply take over the Dutch garrisons on the coast. And the same is true of the rest of India. I mean, the subcontinent, essentially, the British had had a much longer presence there. They'd had stations at places like, bases if you want, at places like Madras and Calcutta, places around the coast. But the interior was dominated by the Indian states. In kind of the north centre, you had the Maratha Confederacy, essentially. The Marathas were Muslim warlords. They had a supreme ruler in Delhi who didn't actually have very much power. The various princely states more or less went their own way and did their own thing.
And in the south, I think you've got states like Mysore and Hyderabad. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And these were powerful states. They were certainly capable of fighting the British. There'd already been a series of wars with Mysore from the 1780s onwards, I think. And, you know, we can't talk about Britain ruling India. What we can talk about is a substantial British presence, which was economically extremely valuable to the British, and which the British are going to be very, very anxious to defend. Whether they were anxious to expand upon it is another matter. Whenever you're talking about the British Empire, you constantly face the issue of where expansion comes from. The British Empire expands, we all know that. But is it expansion driven by London? Well, yes, sometimes it is. Or is it expansion driven by local factors, local players, Brits who happen to be on the scene?
Well, that's clearly what we've seen here, given that there's this interpretation of the letter and then off they go. And that's what Philip has described.
Exactly. And in point of fact, not just this episode, but the subsequent war against Kandy is not sanctioned by London. It's driven by local factors. I think that there are a whole series of issues that we could delve into, but this is probably not the moment to do so.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not a big subscriber to that absent-minded imperialism argument that some have kind of put forward towards the British imperial making. Empire was not absent-minded in its creation process, and of course, the London may have disagreed on what have been done in Asia, but it also went along with it. There is an appetite for imperial empire making there, which to me is very similar to the French appetite for the empire making.
I would genuinely disagree with this. I think it is quite clear in the history of the British Empire that many of the gains that were made were not fueled by London, were fueled by local factors, which, yes, okay, yes, certainly London later sanctioned, later agreed to. But I think it's very, very important to make the point that Britain was not fighting an imperial war.
Well, let's move swiftly on, shall we, before this podcast descends into full on war between our professors, and turn now to France itself. You know, we've got this very odd new form of government consisting of five men sharing power between them, and that's getting its full first calendar year underway. So, you know, it's a very novel experiment, and I've been finding out from Professor Emeritus Bianca Maria Fontana of the University of Lausanne in Switzerland just how odd it is, but also how it's perhaps much maligned and maybe unfairly so. Bianca Maria's most recent publication is a biography of Germaine de Staël, but here she is talking about the subject of the book she's working on at the moment, the much maligned Directory.
The Directory is a collegial government of a type never experienced before in France. This collegial government has one major difficulty, which is it has no head of government. There's no prime minister, no nothing. There is a president just for formal reasons. So basically, there's no unified policy direction. On the other hand, foreign policy and the war are the domain in which directors have more leverage vis-a-vis the assemblies that try to control everything else. But for some reason, this is, you know, it's a rather bizarre constitution, but that it's a field in which they can get on more autonomously from the assemblies, although formally they should always refer to them, but they don't. Now, the problem is, you ask who's running France. That's not very clear, because you have five men of different political orientation. That's why they've been picked. And nothing to keep them together, really. So, for example, someone like Barras takes over simply because he's the only one who's in speaking terms with everybody else. I mean, believe it or not, it is a serious problem.
So what are the main positions taken within the Directory?
Within this framework, there are two main lines of policy. This is quite relevant to the running of the war. The first one is the old Jacobin line. The main representative of it is France war hero Lazare Carnot, the man who saved France in 93, you know, the military engineer who organizes the whole military operation, supplies and so on. Now, Carnot thinks that France should achieve the defense of its natural frontiers, into quote, basically Alps, Pyrenees and the Rhine, but no more than that. And the reason, and that indeed at this stage, France should try to sign as many peace treaties as it is conceivable in order to end the war fast, because ending the war means ending finally the revolution and stabilizing the republic. The counter position, on the other hand, is that of those who either are still involved in the old Girondin position of France liberating Europe, so who are in favor of acquiring territories, but also who have a much more, well, sort of hysterical and worried attitude towards the running of the war. The main person in this new Galaire, who's then supported by Barras, but it's his policy, is an obscure lawyer from Colmar called Jean-François Rebel. And Rebel is from Alsace, which is barely French. Later on, he will have a colleague called Merlin de Douai, another lawyer from the north who's from Lorraine, also barely French. And these people are obsessed with the frontier of the Rhine. The rest doesn't matter. They want to defend the north. They want, if possible, to make agreements with Prussia against Austria. And they will promote the defense of the territory and the occupation of, you know, Belgium, the Low Countries, and so on.
So we've got this big push for the natural frontiers from the one hand, and then a more cautious approach on the other. Which is winning out? Which is top?
The position wins out is the position of those who want to conquer, long before Napoleon had, you know, came along, and before we get the Italian campaign on, I mean, which starts in 96, but it's still not clear where it's going. It's considered a sideshow. The important point is that Cano represents the military, and the military don't want to continue the war. There is a very striking letter, I'll try to be short, but from Cano to Scherrer, who's responsible for the northern sort of front line. And Scherrer is complaining because there's no money, there's no supplies, there's no... And there is a striking letter. Cano was always very laconic. That says, there is no money, no money, no money. So either you get on with what you have or forget about it. So basically, this is the military position, but the politicians are very keen because they realize that occupying territories means getting new cash and getting new resources and strengthening the position of a government, which is otherwise quite feeble in internal terms because it's always fighting with the assemblies.
So for this period, in this 3 months then, these tensions remain more or less unresolved between the two camps?
More or less unresolved, because the only way to make this government function is that each director is responsible for a separate department, and or several separate departments. You know, most of the time they don't interfere with one another. But of course, running the war is the place where you need everyone's support, because you need the money, you need the military, you need all sorts of things. Otherwise, potential conflicts are resolved basically by getting on each of them on his side doing different things.
Well, what about the view of the adversaries, the Prussians, the Austrians, the Russians, and the British? What was the directory's, did it have a collective view on the approach that ought to be taken in the rest of 1796 and beyond?
I think you put in your list, if I may say so, Spain and before Spain, England, more importantly. I think basically the only thing they're worried about is the threat of territorial invasion. So Britain is dangerous because it helps and feeds and supplies the counter-revolutionary, the King's army, but not, you know, they don't expect England to occupy bits of France, essentially. So they don't care very much. Spain is not even on the map. Nobody cares about the Pyrenees, although France does actually, I'm sorry to say it bluntly, but, you know, it's not on the agenda. On the other hand, Austria and Russia are the real menace. Yes, you know, there is the usual colonial rivalry. There has been Toulon and Marseille and so on, but it's not really, they don't consider it their problem anymore in that sense. They really are worried about land, but no, not at this stage. But I think that those 3 months are really those in which nobody's really understanding what's going on, in the sense that they've been handed this government with terrible internal problems. And they're not really focusing very clearly on, you know, they're not sitting there and discussing whom are we going to make peace with, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and the internal problems continue to dominate. So how would you sum up the internal problems that France faced at the start of 96?
Well, I would describe it as the attempt to revert from emergency government to normal one. The most important bit of this is, well, they have a constitution, one that doesn't work very well, but never mind. But the most important bit is to set the economy back to work, because they have to get out of the policy of paper money, of the assignat, which are replaced with some other type of paper money, which is the mandat territorial based on the land. And they're terrified. There's a big fight against all the attempts to speculate on this financial operation. But this is the great priority. The second priority is setting up, and the work they've done in this respect is admirable, the whole public administration. So all the ministries that have been abolished by the revolution, replaced with committees, are restaffed. How do you pay for these people? You don't even have a cash to pay. People don't work for Assignat. So you have to recruit people, you set up a Ministry of Justice, you set up a Ministry of the Interior, then you have to start communicating with all the local administrations that don't understand what you tell them. And to give you, and I'll stop there, just a blank figure, the calculation is that at the end of the revolution, there is something between 30,000 and 40,000 items of legislation that have never come into application, because nobody knows how to do it. So the assembly has, you know, continued to produce this incredible volume of regulation laws and decrees and so on. And the executive either doesn't understand what they want, or doesn't want to do it, or can't do it.
That's Bianca Maria Fontana then telling us all about the directory as it was, and of course is going to be for throughout the season. Hopefully that's not a spoiler. But anyway, Charles, what are your thoughts on the directory at this stage?
Well, key questions. First of all, is a directory going to be able to reimpose the authority of the state? Obviously, under the Jacobins, France was supposedly a centralized state, but of course the Jacobin clubs, the local authorities, exercised considerable power in reality. The key question is the directory going to be able to restore order, broadly defined? Secondly, is the directory going to be able to function effectively as a military machine, if you like? Is it going to be able to feed, pay, recruit, deploy substantial armies, and indeed a substantial fleet? And the third issue is the, if you like, the political direction that France is going to go in. Temporarily, if you like, the more conservative forces in the revolution had reasserted themselves. The Jacobins have been given a good beating. Certainly, there's no question of Jacobin revolution anymore. Is the Directory going to be able to hold the line? Is the Directory going to be able to maintain its unity? All sorts of questions.
And I think, was it right to say that at this stage there were options on the table around approaches towards peace for some of the old allies, including some of the old adversaries, including the British?
At least potentially, some of the powers are thinking, well, can we do a deal with this new regime? And of course, they're encouraged in this by the fact that two major European states, Spain and Prussia, have to deal with the French. Spain got away with quite a moderate peace settlement, and has been now been no, where are we? No, is not yet an ally of the French, but is moving towards becoming an ally of the French. And Prussia, of course, has basically signed a treaty of non-aggression, whereby the Prussians promise to keep their noses out of French affairs, and the French promise to keep their noses out of Prussian affairs. So, yeah, people are looking at it and saying, maybe we can do a deal with this new regime. Maybe it's possible to incorporate the revolution into the, if you like, the European order of things. So again, it's important to realise that there is not this tremendous split between the Ancien regime on the one hand and the revolution on the other. There were always the possibility of bridges being built.
Well, I think, Charles, that a lot of the themes coming through there, I mean, the main theme seems to be one of uncertainty. Would you agree, Alex?
Yes, and I think lack of any trust, really, on the part, because we know that in 1796, in the spring of 96, we see the beginning of several attempts, first of several attempts, to negotiate peace between Britain and France. And what we see is both lack of trust on either side. From the French perspective, the British are not even willing to recognize the existence of the Republican kind of state, or at least that's the perception they have. And the British demands for the terms of the peace are, from the French point of view, unrealistic, because they expect France to return to the previous borders, which France are simply not keen on returning to. And so I think that sets the stage for subsequent kind of narratives, because we know that in the years to come, France will become only more successful and unwilling to consider willingly, let's say on its own, consider giving up the conquered territories, especially when, as you pointed out, Alex, those territories are very lucrative from the point of view of money extraction and resources.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on. And in the remainder of 1796, it's the Austrians who are going to be putting the French forces to the question on the Rhine, of course, but also in North Italy. And in the last episode at the end of 1795, we heard about the Battle of Luano, Rick Schneid talking us through the theatre itself, and Rick will be back for a good long run, starting in the next episode, talking us through North Italy. But for now, here's a return to the podcast for Rafe Blaufarb, Professor of History at Florida State University, to talk about how the development of the French army as an institution has got on by the beginning of 1796. What sort of army was it that Bonaparte is taking command of in North Italy?
The army reorganization that happens in 1796, it is called the Second Amalgam. It's really important because it is a consolidation of the military units that had been created in the First Amalgam, and it results in the dismissal of 20,000 officers, surplus officers. And what that allows the generals like Napoleon to do is purge and select the officer corps. So the army that Napoleon is going to lead into Italy is going to be led by picked and chosen officers who've been culled from this huge mass.
Wow. So they cut out the chaff. They trim it down.
Absolutely. And so this is important to understanding the success of the army. Now, the other thing that's important about the Second Amalgam is why it had to happen in the first place. The reason the Second Amalgam happens is because after the massive expansion of the army in 1793-1794, soldiers begin to desert in droves. They're dragooned into the army and they don't want to be there. And so they very quickly begin leaving, especially after France has been defended, and these volunteers and conscripts, they don't see why they have to be in the army anymore. In 1794, the army numbers 750,000 soldiers. By the time Napoleon invades Italy, it's down to 450,000. Basically, during this whole period, you can desert with impunity. There's no enforcement. There's no mechanism for the state to track you down. There's no punishment. Your local village is happy to have you back. And so basically, by the time Napoleon invades Italy, this necessitates a consolidation of units because their units being, you know, I found one case of a battalion that has three soldiers in it being commanded by 18 officers. You see the problem.
Right. Excellent. That's very good.
and so there's a consolidation to get these, to reduce units, get the number of soldiers in each one up to strength, and then get rid of all these excess officers who are no longer needed to command a smaller number of soldiers. But what it means for the quality of the men Napoleon leads into Italy, it's that those soldiers want to be there. If they didn't want to be there, they would have deserted like everybody else.
So this is what explains their morale being, well, what was their morale? I mean, were they fairly cheerful?
Fantastic.
Yeah.
The only thing, because they're all volunteers, it's a weird way to create a volunteer army. Instead of asking for volunteers, you draft a bunch of people and then allow the ones to leave who want to leave.
and also, they were very well supplied. I mean, the supply, the equipment, there have been significant improvements.
Well, they're not at the beginning of the campaign.
Okay.
The weak point. I want to talk about logistics too. At the beginning of the campaign, the one weak spot is logistics. Soldiers are being paid irregularly. They're not being paid. They're not being paid in actual money. They're being paid in paper money that doesn't buy anything. And so the logistic and pay system, it has broken down. And I want to explain why. They become better supplied when they pour down into the Po Valley and begin looting stuff and taking stuff. Or more specifically, when Napoleon organizes what he calls contributions from the towns he is quote-unquote liberating.
Right.
That gives him a pile of actual money that he is able to use to actually pay his soldiers for the first time in years and to supply them.
Why were they so cheerful then when they weren't being paid in actual, coin metal they could bite, but they were pretty happy anyway?
I think the prospect, two things. The prospect of moving into the untouched Po Valley. This is the richest agricultural area of continental Europe, and it hasn't had a battle fought on it. It's untouched. They know that, and Napoleon tells them, that they're going to have full bellies and full wallets when they get there.
Wow, that had never occurred to me. That never occurred to me as the prospect of the prize being there would be so tantalizing for them and actually help them fight. Wow.
Absolutely. But actually, until, there are problems in the army. There are actual mutinies in the army in 1796, largely because of the lack of pay and supplies.
Oh, dear.
So the army is actually, they're all volunteers, but they feel that the state is letting them down and not supplying them. But here comes this general who says, "I promise you, we are heading into a land of milk and honey, and the hard time will soon be over." And they're enthused to get on with it, I think.
What about the generals? Bonaparte's generals were they a mixed bag?
Well, they're all very experienced by this point. Most of them had been veterans of the old Royal Army. They had been like sergeants and stuff, and they've been fighting for a number of years. So they're good. They're actually quite good. I don't know if they're independent military geniuses, but they can fight battles if they're given the proper orders. And some of them I think are fairly, they have are capable of independent action. Massena so the generals are good. I would argue that the army Napoleon takes into Italy is the best army that France ever has.
No way. Really? And so, because within broader French plans, you always think about it in terms of the, you've still got the Rhine
deal with and defend, and the Army of Italy is sort of an also-ran. But obviously it's the most compelling one because the Rhine Army didn't achieve much. But why the difference? Why? Because those reforms that you've talked about will have affected all the different armies that France was fielding at the time. So why is it the Army of Italy that is the most, you think, the best of them all?
Yeah, you're right. Well, you've hit the weak point of what I just said.
Oh, sorry.
No, the reforms were the same throughout the entire French military establishment. I guess at that, you'd have to probably say it has to do with the commanders at that point. If I wanted to try to make a lawyer's argument about, you know, why the Army of Italy was best, maybe I'd say that the terrain over which the Army of the Rhine is fighting has been fought over and fought over. It's not as rich agriculturally. It's been picked over, and consequently, it's harder for armies to operate there. They're more attached to supply trains, which are cumbersome, and the French at this point in time are really incapable of mounting effective logistical efforts. But Napoleon, when he shows up in Italy, it is the promised land, and he can basically turn his units loose and say, you don't need a supply line, just go wherever, you'll find your food where you go. That may not be the case in Germany. I mean, I know they're fighting in the Black Forest, which is not super agriculturally rich.
But as a fighting force, what a change from 1789. This is a real transformation.
The backdrop to all this logistical stuff, and also, issues of army morale, is hyperinflation. Are you familiar with that? With the overthrow of Robespierre and the decision to make France more liberal, all of the price controls collapse, and the currency, the paper currency, is no longer obligatory. Unfortunately, though, the government is still stuck with paying its military contractors with paper money. It doesn't have any silver money. And so the contractors charge hugely, hugely inflated prices to make up for the risk that they're incurring by accepting inflatable paper money. And it's just a cycle of hyperinflation. Meanwhile, the ordinary soldier is having his pay paid in this paper money, but he can't buy supplemental rations because peasants won't sell him anything for it. I saw a letter in the archives. This is actually from the Army of the Rhine at the period you were talking about. Some soldiers are marching through Alsace, on the French side of the border. This is before the fight. And it's hot and dry. And so they stop at a farm and ask the peasant lady if they can have a glass of water. And she says no. And then they offer to pay her in the paper money for water. And she won't accept any amount of paper money for water.
Oh, no. That's when you know you have a problem.
That's a real problem. And it also reveals something else, that the army by this point, by the end of 1795, is beginning to feel cut off and abandoned by the rest of French society, abandoned by a state that can't pay it or supply it, and abandoned by civilians who just want to see them, go away.
Yes. So this really was an army marching on its stomach and seeing that actually the its salvation lay ahead of it, not behind it.
Yep. And with a growing chip on its shoulder against domestic France, both the state and society, a sense that the army alone is making the sacrifices for the revolution. We are alone bearing the torch of the revolution. Everyone else has become greedy and, they don't care about us anymore. They're abandoning us.
Well, there's Ralph Blaufarb, and he's giving us a really good picture there of the state of the French army as an institution by the end of this first quarter of 1796. And you might notice that what we're doing with Rafe is he's taking sort of key moments throughout this revolutionary and Napoleonic period and analysing where the French army's got to. And this is one of those moments, because this is the machine that Napoleon Bonaparte, as well as Jourdan and Moreau, of course, are going to be dealing with and using for France's ends in the rest of 1796. And really, I think, Charles, is it right that this is all about the professionalization of the French army?
Yes, there's a very strong tendency to imagine that not only is there an ideological divide between the French and the rest, but there's also an organizational divide between the French and the rest. Yes, France is a republic, revolutionary, and so forth, and the Ancien Régime is Ancien. The French army is a nation in arms, and the armies of the Ancien Régime are composed of professional soldiers. This simply doesn't work for 1796 and 1797, 1798. The army's wasting away because of desertion, which is enormous, and because of illness. And of course, there's fighting as well. I mean, every battle, every skirmish costs the French a few more soldiers, even if they win. So you've got an army which is, by default, professionalised. And because it's professionalised, it is no longer an army of the nation. It's no longer a nation in arms. And that opens the way for its interests to be different from those of the nation, and that in turn opens the way for ambitious generals such as Napoleon, and there are others as well, ambitious generals to think in terms of using the army to seize power.
Wow, that is so good. Such a good point to make, because it's laying the groundwork for all sorts of developments which might or might not follow. But what I think is so interesting here, Alex, is that you've got the politics of what's going on in France, and now potentially the army coming in as a political actor. Not yet, of course, but the two are both relevant and they're a little bit intertwined. So let's ask you, Alex, about the politics of what's going on in Paris at the time. You've got the directors in charge, the assembly's busily doing their thing, passing all those laws that aren't going to get anywhere. How do the two interact, and what is your sense of the state of politics in France at this stage?
In a word, polarized, divisive, because in the fall of 95, we've seen this creation of this new political system with the collegiate government led by the directorate. Now, the five directors of this time are the Barras, who is, I think, the nicest way to put is very duplicitous. Revalier Lepot, who was a fierce Republican and anti-Catholic. We have Rubel, who claimed expertise in foreign affairs and was a close ally of Barras, and a moderate Republican. We have Le Tourneau, who was a former captain of engineers and more hands-on in military affairs, and of course, Lazare Carnot. The problem, of course, is that the five directors don't look eye to eye on many things. They disagree on politics, they disagree on strategy. But even bigger problem that France is facing and the directory is facing, the problem that will shape French policies, the reality that France has not recovered, has not made any headway in terms of economic or financial recovery. In fact, when the directory met, Revalier Lepot gave his remarkable description of financial state of France, in which treasury was empty, he says. Not a single sou was remaining, that assignats were worthless, that the wages were not keeping up with inflation, that one louis d'or, which was worth 2,000 livres just a year ago, was reaching 5,000 livres, that the price of wine and bread was increasing exponentially. So how will this government handle these issues? Well, one answer would be, as we alluded to, is through conquests, through subsidizing French economy by exploiting the territories elsewhere. But the directory is facing internal challenges. Challenges in the spring of 1796 of the radical left again rearing its head, and the conspiracy of equals led by François Noël Babeuf, right, the Krakus Babeuf, are being organized. In fact, Babeuf will be soon enough arrested, right, that spring in 96. But this was a powerful challenge to the Directory. So all these challenges mean that when it comes to the Directory, the major preoccupation before the directors is to secure the what we now call the natural frontiers and to extract resources to somehow offset the ongoing economic and financial challenges. That's a very difficult task, especially when they were confronted by the unseen regime armies, which Charles said we're not just simply killing over and letting the French win, right? There's a seesaw battle going on, and no one expects a breakthrough.
Yes, this has been the great theme, that actually you really can't write off these ancien regime armies. They are very professional, but now they're up against something just as professional, potentially, and that's a big change.
Well, okay, enough of all this liberty, equality, and stupidity nonsense. Let's move to the ancien regime.
Hold on, let me chuckle here. go on.
As I was saying, let's move on to the ancien regime. There's a very sort of widespread perception that the armies of the ancien regime are antiquated, and indeed that the ancien regime is antiquated. This is completely wrong. The armies of the ancien regime were, in fact, professional forces. They were well-trained. They were well-disciplined. They were very good at what they did and what they'd been created for. Okay, they're in a new situation. The other thing to say is that the ancien regime is by no means as antiquated as everybody makes out. The ancien regime was actually highly reformist. If you look at Europe in the second half of the 18th century, you have the age of enlightened absolutism, it's called, and you have a series of reformist monarchs, Charles III of Spain, for example, Joseph of Austria, Catherine the Great in Russia, the whole series of them dotted around the continent, engaged in a process of reform driven by the state. And everywhere, the target is the aristocracy, the general desire to reduce the power of the aristocracy. There's also a general desire to reduce the power of the Catholic Church in particular. Protestant churches in the German states, they tended to be pretty subservient to the state already. The Catholic Church wasn't. So you have this ongoing process of reform. Now, it's often said that the French Revolution happens and everybody says, oh my God, we can't go down this road, we can't engage in reform. That simply isn't true. Reform continues. And you particularly see it in the area of military affairs. So the Austrian army, which had not performed that badly up until now, from 1796 onwards, we're going to see it moving into a period of reform, gradual reform, certainly, captained by the Archduke Charles, the Emperor's younger brother, or one of his younger brothers. In Spain, you see really quite a determined effort at military reform being driven through by the royal favourite, who's been... in fact, effectively prime minister, chief minister since 1793, Manuel Ligodoy.
Well, this all sounds very straightforward. They can just crack on and make these changes and improve very straightforwardly.
There is a problem. Already, prior to 1789, the rulers of Europe had run into massive opposition from the privileged orders, from the church, from the aristocracy. And this had limited their ability to push through reform. In France, where there hadn't been much enlightened absolutism, when they finally get round to it in 1788, it's completely stymied by what's called the revolt of the aristocracy, and that's partly why the revolution happens. Pushing through reform, then, is going to be a tricky process. And we're going to see limits to the extent that it could be pushed through, and some pretty dramatic events happening along the way, up to and including the murder of one or two of Europe's monarchs. In fact, Gustav III of Sweden had in fact already been assassinated in 1792 in a court plot headed by the Royal Guard, led by aristocratic officers who were annoyed at royal policy. So the Ancien regime does not remain static in the face of the French threat. It tries to do something about the French threat, but at the risk of destabilizing itself. And that is going to be a tension that we're going to see working itself out from now right up until, 1806 in Prussia.
Yes, you're right, Charles. This is going to be a long process, but there is fighting to come in months, indeed, in the weeks to come at the end of this quarter. And particularly the Austrian forces are coming up against the French on the Rhine and, of course, in Italy. And so these are the questions, I think. I think in this episode, we've had a pretty good crack at surveying the overall picture, as the forces themselves are mostly in winter quarters. But things are going to change very dramatically in the next episode and thereon. I just wonder what you would both say to conclude this episode of the Napoleonic Quarterly. Were the biggest question marks on the minds of those in power in Europe? On 31st March 1796, if there was a note being written, or if you're able to have a chat with some of these rulers, what questions would they be asking themselves and pondering about what 1796, the rest of 1796, holds in store?
Well, I know which one they will not write down on that note, and that is what will happen in Italy with the appointment of this, 28-year-old young commander, an unknown figure in many respects, who has not commanded a unit larger than a division, right? Being sent to command an army of Italy. I know that this would be not the area that anyone in late March of 1796 would have concerned themselves with, because Austrians and Piedmontese clearly had a superiority in numbers and experience, and this was supposed to be a diversionary place. I think the primary concern would have been Rhineland, right? This is where we would expect the fate of this war of the First Coalition to be decided. This is where France's most troops are concentrated. This is where Austrian attention is on. That's the great question. Would Austrians hold the ground? Would the French achieve a breakthrough?
And Charles?
Yeah, I would build on that. I would agree with it. I'd slightly build on it and say that the a very important theatre of operations, and one which is much more important now, or going to be much more important now, is actually southern Germany. Yes, until now, the Rhineland had been very much the focus of the war. There had been some French incursions across the Rhine, further south, from places like Strasbourg and so forth. Southern Germany is now going to be much more important as a theatre of operations, and that's where we're going to see a number of very important clashes, which actually are going to have a lot to do with the emergence of Napoleon as a major figure.
Yes, it's all still to come. It's all still to come. We're on the brink.
Well, in Russia, there's growing uncertainty because the Empress Catherine the Great is very elderly, clearly is going to die at some point. There is going to be a new Tsar in the person of Paul I, over whom there are a number of question marks. Prussia is sitting happily in its neutral zone, and it's thinking very much in terms about how it can acquire fresh territory in Germany through some sort of reorganization of the Holy Roman Empire. Britain is pretty heavily involved in colonial issues. If you look at the British war effort as a whole, what tends to happen is It switches between the colonies and Europe. When the British can get involved in Europe, they do. When they can't get involved in Europe, they fight the French elsewhere, particularly in the colonies. So Britain is chiefly interested in what's going to happen in the colonies, and is also very worried about the possibility of a descent on England. France now has the Dutch as allies. The Spaniards, well, at this point, it's not quite clear what's happening, but they're certainly no longer on the British side. The Dutch and the Spaniards are both powerful naval powers. They've got ships. If the French can control those ships, that's a very worrying development, because you look back to the days of the American Revolutionary War, when Britain had really been brought to its knees by an alliance of France, Spain and Holland. So the British are going to be worried about that sort of thing. The Spaniards, you've got a reformist chief minister, Manuel de Godoy, who is in a very tricky situation personally. He's a reformist and he's hated because he's a reformist. But Spain is very much engaged in its, or obsessed, if you like, with its own internal position at this point, at the beginning of 1796. We're going to see that change. But the point is that France is not facing a massive coalition of the European powers anymore. Yes, there's Britain. Yes, there's Austria. Yes, there's Piedmont and a number of other Italian states. But it's no longer a question of the French versus the rest.
So that's the situation then as the spring of 1796 approaches. Thanks to both Charles Esdale and Alex Mica-Baridze. Thanks to Philip Bull, Bianca Maria Fontana and Rafe Blaufarb. Thanks to my very old friend Ben Eckersley for composing and performing all the music you've heard in this episode. He says he still hasn't listened to any of it. It's outrageous, but he's very nice of him to do the music anyway. Come on, Ben! Anyway, at the end of this quarter, there's 7,017 days to go until Waterloo, and I hope you'll join me in due course for episode 18, and among my guests for that will be Rick Schneid to describe Bonaparte's astonishing progress against the Piedmontese and the Austrians.
One of the key things is his pursuit of a defeated enemy, never giving them a moment's respite. He grabs hold of the enemy and doesn't let go until they are destroyed.